from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Averting a government default, the House of Representatives passed a bill yesterday raising the debt ceiling and reducing government spending. We focus in the hour ahead on the bill, now expected to be passed by the Senate, and we'll find out why liberals and many of President Obama's fellow Democrats are angry and feel the president, well, and columnist and economist Paul Krugman's choice of verbs, surrendered to the GOP and the Tea Party. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, the House of Representatives ended a long stalemate over the debt ceiling and budget by passing a bipartisan-supported bill raising the debt ceiling and reducing government spending, cutting at least $2.1 trillion from projected borrowing over the next decade. The bill, which is expected to pass in the Senate, has no provisions for new taxes. It extends the borrowing authority of the Treasury Department, and it creates a new joint congressional committee to recommend changes in spending and possibly in tax policy to reduce the deficit. Many supporters of the president and many on the left are angry and have been arguing that President Obama caved in to Republican demands or, as New York Times columnist Paul Krugman put it, surrendered to GOP extortion over the debt ceiling. This opening forum hour, we discuss the House bill and political after effects. We'll be talking to local congressional representatives as well as a number of people that we want to talk to who have different opinions and particularly are looking at this in terms of a lot of the political fallout as well as the particulars of the bill. We want to go first to Washington and welcome Jared Bernstein, who is senior fellow with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you. Well, since I read off your bona fides here as being an economic advisor to Vice President Biden, he used the word terrorists about the Republicans, and it's been used a couple of times now. And I'm wondering, not necessarily about the language itself, but about the idea that, well, President Obama gave in to terrorism or surrendered to a kind of extortion, as Paul Krugman said.
I think that's one way to look at it, and it's not entirely wrong, but I think the president was essentially trying to bargain and negotiate with people who refused to do so from the very beginning, and he made a choice that he wasn't going to allow these reckless ideologues to take the economy over a cliff with the first default in the history of our nation. Folks, I think, can definitely argue, and I think persuasively, that the other side was completely intransigent. They can argue that the president's negotiating skills weren't up to snuff. I can certainly see that point as well. But at the end of the day, I think the stage kind of was set for the end game when, at the very beginning, a sizable group of House Republicans said there's absolutely no way we would ever vote to support this thing. And at that point, you knew you weren't dealing with folks who were willing to negotiate.
Well, we framed this morning in terms of how the deal has fallen in terms of the Democratic Party and the left's response to it. And there's a lot of anger. I mean, House Democrats are angry over this and complaints that the White House ignored them and complaints that President Obama was lacking in leadership.
I'm angry, too. I mean, I'm angry about the outcome. I think what we ended up here with was an extremely imbalanced piece of legislation. It's possible that all of these cuts could end up accomplished through the spending side exclusively. I think the president throughout the debate talked about the importance of having some revenue increases, some new revenues in the deal to offset these spending cuts, not for aesthetic purposes, but because if you don't get some revenues, some tax revenues in the deal, you end up putting much too much pressure on the spending side, and that leads to deep cuts in parts of the government that are really important, whether it's retirement security, education, infrastructure, research. So much of what we really need right now to move this economy forward is going to take a real hit in this deal. So I feel the very anger and pain you're describing.
Jared Bernstein again with us from Washington, senior fellow with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Biden. Jackie Speier is also joining us from Washington, Democratic congresswoman with the U.S. House of Representatives, who represents the 12th Congressional District, which encompasses the southwest quarter of San Francisco and most of adjacent San Mateo County. And good morning, Congresswoman Speier.
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm okay, and I imagine you're still probably holding your nose.
No, of course I am. This is one of those Hobson choices that are very, very difficult. I mean, we could not default. Default was truly not an option. And the president, I think, could have done a much better job in negotiating this deal. The only compensation we can get in this is the following, and this came out loud and clear when Vice President Biden met with the Democratic caucus yesterday morning, and that is that the revenues that your previous caller was talking about are going to be part of this formula. In fact, he has made it very clear that the Bush tax cuts will expire at the end of next year, and they will not be renewed. He made that very clear in his conversations with us. So that, coupled with the fact that the cuts don't really take effect until 2013, gives us a little breathing room in terms of helping to stoke the economy to get it out of the stalled position that it's presently in.
Are those the kind of positive spins, along with $10 billion in defense cuts, that Democrats are, like you, who voted in favor of the bill, are at least trying to salvage from this? Because there were no tax increases, and the spending cuts were pretty much along the lines of what Paul Ryan had outlined initially, about two-thirds of what he wanted, he said he got.
Well, I think, he wants to certainly spin it that way. He did not get what he wants. I mean, we kept Medicare protected, we kept Social Security protected, we kept Medicaid funding and programs for the poor protected, we kept Pell Grants protected for those in college, so he's actually wrong in that regard. And for the first time, truly, for the very first time, we're talking seriously about making cuts to the defense budget that should have been made decades ago. But 50% of the cuts would be imposed on the defense budget if this joint committee does not complete its work and it does not get approved by Congress. So those are the areas that we've got to really pay special attention to. I feel so strongly about the defense cuts being part of the solution that I'm in the process of hiring a staff person who is going to exclusively be looking at the defense budget and where we can start making cuts there.
Let me go back to Jared Bernstein. Jared Bernstein, your response to Congresswoman Speier's support of the bill on the basis of what she said so far, along with, by the way, the trigger exemptions being a small victory as the Democrats see it as well.
So a couple of points on what the Congresswoman said. First of all, I would have, if I were in Congress, and I'm not, I've never gotten a vote in my life for anything, so I say this with respect, I would have been an aye vote also. I would have supported it based on the very point she made about default. But there are a couple of things that I would disagree with in what you just heard. First of all, according to Congressional Budget Office, and I think they're right on this, the cuts don't start in 2013. The cuts start in 2012. There's $21 billion of cuts in 2012. Now, $21 billion in an economy of $15 trillion is not a tremendous setback, but it's going in exactly the wrong direction. Secondly, on the Bush tax cuts, on the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, any member of this administration, which I used to work for, that told me, thanks to this deal, we can be assured that the high end of the Bush tax cuts would sunset, my response would be, I thought we were assured of that anyway. So the idea that somehow the signing of this bill increases the probability that the high end Bush tax cuts would be allowed to expire, I find a little bit alarming, because I kind of thought that was going to happen anyway.
Let me go back to you, Jackie Speier.
Well, I would agree to a certain extent with Jared, although we've already seen that the Bush tax cuts that were supposed to expire last year ended up not expiring, and that the president negotiated a deal, which, frankly, I could not stomach and voted against. So I feel very strongly that that tax holiday that was provided by President Bush should have expired. It is absolutely unacceptable on any level that we can continue to pursue that kind of spending, and that's what it is. Those tax cuts turn out to be spending that we can't afford.
I also want to mention, Congresswoman Speer, I read your statement on the debt bill, and you said we have a greater crisis in this country, the jobs deficit, and just not being a deadbeat is nothing to celebrate. But I want to thank you for joining us and appreciate your time. We're going to actually be joined by another local Bay Area Congresswoman, Zoe Lofgren, who is also a Democrat with the U.S. House of Representatives representing the 16th Congressional District. And Congresswoman Lofgren, good to have you with us this morning. Welcome to the program.
Good. Glad to be on.
Well, you voted no. Why?
I think it's a bad deal. We have, a deficit problem, but a more extreme problem we're facing is an unemployment problem. We have 14 million Americans out of work. 6 of them have been 6 million longer than 6 months. And it's a major cause of the revenue shortfall that we're experiencing, which is contributing to the debt. And here we go with cuts to the economy at a time when it's likely to aggravate our desperate unemployment situation. And even if we're going to, we obviously do need to deal with our debt situation, but to do that without any revenue is absurd. Now, I don't criticize my colleagues who voted for this. I mean, it was, I think, half the Democrats voted yes, half voted no, because we were put in an absurd position. We had these radicals in the Republican Party who basically held America hostage until they got their way, and they were willing to blow up the American economy if they didn't get their way. It put us in a very tough spot.
Could you comment for us on the president's leadership or lack of leadership in this whole crisis and impasse that was, at least at this point, finally the logjam has been broken? But as you know, many within your party and many on the left have been highly critical of President Obama's lack of leadership and, frankly, his negotiating skills or lack thereof.
Well, I think there have been some missteps. In December, when the Democrats still were the majority in the House, many of us suggested that we not extend the Bush tax cuts, and further, that we deal with this debt ceiling issue right then, because, you know, we could see these new guys, and, I mean, they're a different kind of group, I'll tell you that.
By these new guys, you mean the Tea Party mainly.
That's exactly right. And I don't understand why the president did what he did. I didn't agree with it, but, you know, he's the president, I'm not. So here we ended up first with a crisis where the Republicans threatened to shut the government down if they didn't get their way on the continuing resolution. Then this extended circus with the world watching where, I mean, the government of the United States looks absurd, unless they got their way. And it's not over. I mean, we're going to have another shutdown, I'm sure, another shutdown crisis in September, October, when it comes for the next budget. And likely, we'll have another kind of dust-up towards December, because these guys are radicals. They don't really believe in the American political system. And I think the president has... I would have preferred a firmer hand from the beginning.
Well, we should mention that the Senate is now voting on the deal, and it's expected that the Senate will pass it. But, Congresswoman, do you think that, the Democrats kind of gave away the House here? I mean, gave away in the terms of caving in, and the president simply didn't use his bully pulpit enough, or that, as some have argued, he just was maybe too AWOL?
Well, you know, When he put this deal together, it really the Democrats in the House didn't have much of a chance to do something different, honestly. This is the president's plan, and I think, you know, he'll answer for that next year. I think that there's tremendous dissatisfaction in the country about the deal, but also about the the firmness with which this has been dealt with, and I'm hopeful that this will be instructive to the president, because, you know, you really can't negotiate with hostage takers. We know that as part of our State Department policy, and it ought to be the policy in the White House as well. We all have to be willing to make compromises. You know, plenty of times I've had to vote for things that wasn't exactly what I wanted. That's the nature of this American political system. But that's a little bit different than holding hostage the economy of the world unless you get your way. And that's what we saw here.
Zoe Lofgren, thank you so much for joining us on Forum this morning.
You bet.
Again, Zoe Lofgren is Congresswoman, California's 16th District. And we're going to bring William Galston into this conversation. He's a senior fellow in governance study with the Brookings Institution. He's also former deputy assistant for domestic policy in the Clinton administration, and he's up in Cape Cod. And William Galston, good to have you with us here. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
I guess I'd like your perspective on this, because you feel this crisis could have been avoided with a different turn of leadership, even though I know you're sympathetic with the president and the kind of exigencies and pressures that he was under, but he could have avoided the crisis how?
Well, there's no. I agree with Congresswoman Lofgren that the Democrats could have decided to raise the debt ceiling by themselves last December, and in retrospect, that looks like a pretty good idea. And the Congresswoman is correct that to many people it looked like a pretty good idea at the time. The President, however, was far from alone in counseling a different path. The Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, said explicitly that he wanted to make sure that Republicans had some fingerprints in 2011 on any raising of the debt ceiling. That didn't work out too well. Having said that, the question on the table and the focus of the immediate concern and anger is the deal itself. And there I have to say I think a lot of the anger is misplaced. I think the president and his team did a pretty good job in the end game of protecting things that they and most Democrats care about the most. You've heard about some of them already. A lot of the domestic programs that focus on assistance to poor and working class families were protected, including Medicaid. The cuts to Medicare are focused on providers and are capped at 2%, which is less than draconian. Special measures were built into the agreement to bolster Pell grants. And as a previous caller mentioned, the cuts in the fiscal year 2012, beginning in October of 2011, are really minimal. $25 billion, according to CBO, in a $15 trillion economy. It amounts, my calculation is, to 0.7% of the total federal budget. I don't expect that to have a huge impact on the economy. And, of course, there's a phase two. The cuts that have been agreed to specifically up to now are less than half of what will eventually be agreed to, and the commission that's been constituted, the Select Commission of Members of Congress, is empowered to consider everything, including tax reform that could increase revenues. And you might say, well, that's not going to happen. On the other hand, there is also a very powerful trigger in the form of budget cuts, automatic budget cuts, if this select committee cannot come to an agreement. And those automatic budget cuts include hundreds of billions of dollars in defense cuts that many Republicans and conservatives are very upset about, and that gives them an incentive to bargain more flexibly than they have in the past 6 months. So those are just some of the points that could be offered in favor of this deal.
Well, let me go to sort of the other side of that for a moment, because Jared Bernstein, I think, sees a great deal of concern about those who have been critical of the president in the effect this has had on many good programs which are already under budget constraints, such as money going into infrastructure and education and research and clean energy and childcare and housing and help to the poor. I mean, Jared Bernstein I hate to give out a laundry list like that, but these programs are clearly going to be affected by this, aren't they?
You absolutely should give out a laundry list like that. In fact, the alternative is to say $2.1 trillion over 10 years, which, by the way, nobody has any idea what you're talking about. So the only way to understand the costs is to elaborate it just the way you did. Look, I think the bill, if I were in Congress, I would have voted for it because default is too costly an option. But I think Bill dresses this bill up much too prettily, although much of what he said I agree with. I think at the end, Democrats were able to make it less bad. But that's still bad in some of the following ways. One very important way he didn't mention. First of all, the first round of cuts, a trillion in what's called a discretionary spending, $350 billion is supposed to be in defense. So that helps take about a third off of the pressure of the categories you listed. But the president himself stated that this brings this kind of discretionary spending down to the lowest level since Eisenhower, which is, you know, something like 50 plus years ago. If anyone believes that in this economy, with the challenges that we face on so many levels, whether it's vulnerable people like retirees or kids in low-income families, childcare programs, food programs, if you're talking about folks like that, clearly they need more help, not less help. And then on the investment side, same thing. But here's another problem with this bill. I was on television last night and this morning talking about this, debating with a few Republicans from the Senate. Both of them said the same thing. They said, from now on, any legislation to increase the debt ceiling will no longer be a clean increase. From now on, every increase in the debt ceiling, we will insist on a dollar-for-dollar spending cut per dollar of increase in the debt ceiling. That's how we're going to impose budget discipline on the federal government going forward. Not in the budget process, which is where they should be imposing budget discipline. And in fact, in the budget process, they know when they pass a budget whether they're going to breach the debt ceiling or not. So what these folks are basically saying is, we're going to budget irresponsibly. We're going to spend more than we have. And then when it comes time to borrow to make up the difference, we're going to hand the check back to the American people and threaten to take this economy off a cliff unless they give us our way. That is a very dangerous precedent.
Well, it is a precedent also that suggests a very different type of fiscal policy than we've seen heretofore, and also pretty much supports the idea that government is not necessarily going to help in this economic crisis or this unemployment crisis, that it's going to have to be continuing cutting spending and bringing down the debt ceiling. I'm going to open up the phone lines, and certainly you are welcome to join us with your thoughts about what has occurred here. And as I said, we're talking about the fact that the House of Representatives passed a bill to raise the debt ceiling on Monday evening, expected to pass the Senate today. You may want to put in your own contribution to this conversation with any questions or comments. And we're particularly talking about some of the anger that is occurring among Democrats and on the left, supporters of President Obama, as well as those who have been critical of him from the progressive camp. And indeed, we'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius Satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join us now at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. We'll continue with Jared Bernstein, who's Senior Fellow with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and with William Galston, who is a Senior Fellow in Governance Studies with the Brookings Institution. We spoke earlier with a couple of congressional representatives here in the Bay Area, Jackie Speer and Zoe Lofgren, and we'll find out what you have to say when we return. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour is on the debt agreement that went through the House of Representatives yesterday and the anger among some Democrats. Will liberal dissatisfaction over the compromise pose a political problem for the president? Certainly, the president's leadership has been criticized. Of course, there's been a lot of criticism of the way this was handled by the Republicans and the way default was essentially held over the president's head like the sword of Damocles, as many have been saying. In fact, some of the language here has been unlike things we've heard from public officials in quite some time, even Nancy Pelosi talking about a side of Satan in response to, I haven't heard Satan evoked since Hugo Chavez was in the United Nations. This was in response to Emmanuel Cleaver, a congressman, saying that this was a Satan-like or deal with Satan. And Congresswoman Pelosi, minority leader of the House, said with Satan fries on the side, or words to that effect. We're talking with Jared Bernstein, senior fellow with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Biden. And we're also talking with William Galston, senior fellow in governance studies with the Brookings Institution and former deputy assistant for domestic policy in the Clinton administration. We wanted to bring another voice into this. That's Michael Doyles, who's a reporter with the Washington Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers, who is in the D.C., in the nation's capital. The Senate, by the way, I was just informed, passed the bill, so it is now law once the president signs it, of course, which is expected to go on. And there are about 866,000 Californians who are paying for college with federal Pell Grants, as Michael Doyle says in his article in the Sacramento Bee, and they should count themselves lucky, but there's a lot of others who perhaps are going to count themselves unlucky as a result of this bill. And Michael Doyle, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk about who's hurt here. Your headline says federal cuts likely to hit California farm subsidies, defense spending, high-speed rail. I guess Dan Lundgren already has said that high-speed rail is probably out of the picture.
Well, the thing about the massive cut, and wide-ranging is it will, though not yet spelled out in detail, it will enable Republicans, primarily in the House, to target programs that they've long had animus toward. High-speed rail has been one that many, including Mr. Lundgren, are very skeptical about further federal investment, and both because they have policy grounds, they don't like the ongoing subsidies. There's political motives. They like to bash a policy priority of the presidency. And now, with the necessity to come up with further federal savings, it's tailor-made ending or for the severely curtailing future federal investments in high-speed rail funding. We should say, just on this example and others, we won't know for some time where the specific cuts will come from. That will unfold both in the coming weeks and then when a special 12-member committee is appointed to make further cuts. But if I were to pinpoint among the most vulnerable potential federal programs, high-speed rail spending would be one of them.
Well, you also, in your article, said, I think probably correctly, that and with prescience, that the Central Valley farm subsidies are sure to change.
Yes. Now, we should say that every 5 years, Congress writes a farm bill that spells out how subsidies are paid, and every 5 years there's an effort to change them, and there's much critical attention paid to them, and every 5 years they pretty much withstand the assaults. What's going to happen next year is there will be a new five-year farm bill, and there are a lot of skeptics, including in the Republican caucus, about federal spending to subsidize particularly wealthy farmers. And I think it's almost certain that there will be changes in demanded in how much money goes to farming and how it goes. And, of course, in the Central Valley of California is where the majority of the subsidies go for cotton and rice. Now, here we should say, unlike states like Iowa or Kansas, California is relatively undependent on federal crop subsidies. So in certain regions of the state, they will see a diminution of federal spending, but that will not probably be one of the larger impacts on the state.
What about defense spending?
Well, that's going to take a significant haircut. The deal calls for on the order of $350 billion in savings over 2 years in defense. That's actually less of a reduction than the Obama administration had called for. It does not specify where those cuts will come from, but California's defense industry, much of it in Southern California, is clearly vulnerable. Their production facilities for the F-22 fighter, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which have been under political siege for some time for policy and budgetary grounds, now that once again there will be reason to target them for elimination or curtailment. Defense spending was one of the issues that causes some conservative Republicans pause. They don't like to see reduction in defense spending, but it was deemed to be a necessary part of the final package.
Michael Doyle, again with us from Washington, reporter for the Washington Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers, and thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We should mention, by the way, that California is bound to get a hit because the federal government just last year spent $345 billion in California. That will obviously shrink as a result. And this bill calls for the committee members to this new congressional committee to be named within a couple weeks. It's unlikely that there will be California's name to it. But we will continue in just a moment to – or we will begin in just a moment to take your calls and emails. I want to go back, however, to William Galston, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies. And we heard from Jackie Speer before, William Galston, about what's to salvage in this bill and the positive sides of this bill, and we heard some of that from you as well. Overall, however, there seems to be a great deal, again, of criticism of President Obama, and is he taking too much flack here and undeservedly so?
I am told that when Vice President Biden, for whom Jared Bernstein used to work, appeared before Democrats in both the House and the Senate, he began his briefing and defense of what the administration had agreed to by reminding everybody in the room that elections matter in American politics. There was a big election in 2010 that substantially reduced the Democrats' majority in the Senate and handed over the House of Representatives to the Republican Party outright. And in the House of Representatives, with no filibuster rule, the majority rules. And if you're on the short end of the numerical stick in the House, you have no more power than the majority chooses to give you. So that was a huge power shift that occurred in November of last year. And everything that the administration has had to do subsequently has occurred within the context of that power shift. And so although I've been critical of some of the president's tactics, I have a lot of sympathy for people inside the administration who are asking their critics some very blunt questions. What would you have done?
Well, here's a listener who suggests, and I've brought it up in these discussions in the past. This listener, Barry, says, how close was the president to considering the 14th Amendment in an effort to get what he wanted? Would the potential fallout have affected his ability in one way or the other in next year's presidential election? And you know, we kept hearing about the possibility of his evoking the 14th Amendment, not necessarily that he would have had support from Congress, but he wouldn't have necessarily needed it, would he?
Let's first of all recall that a bunch of liberal constitutional lawyers, including Lawrence Tribe of Harvard, who is arguably the most prominent of them all.
And who was President Obama's mentor, in fact, yeah.
President Obama's mentor at Harvard, have argued very strongly against the constitutionality of proceeding in that fashion. Could the president have gotten away with it? Probably, at least for a while, but it would have triggered a constitutional crisis. People would have been marching in the streets calling for his impeachment. Congress, at least in the House of Representatives, might very well have started down that road. It would have brought everything else to a screaming halt between now and the presidential election. And so the president looked at the constitutional arguments, he looked at the political arguments, and I think he reached an eminently defensible judgment. It makes people feel good to say, well, the president could have just done what he wanted. But the president, I think, was cooler and wiser than that.
Let us bring our callers into this. And, Mark, we begin with you. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a Democrat in San Francisco, and I'm really upset with the way things worked out. But at the same time, I have to realize that I think that some of this outcome was sort of inevitable. There's no American left in this country. I think that there's that, you know, if you have a strong, motivated, committed Tea Party on the right and no adamant answering voices on the left, this is what your politics looks like. And I was just wondering if there was any comment about what it would take to, you know, why is the left so silent under these circumstances?
Well, the left is not silent in terms of the criticism of the president, but William Galston, the caller, has a point here. There isn't certainly an ideological flank anymore comparable to what the Tea Party has brought about.
He absolutely has a point, and he's pointing out something very important about the basic structure of American politics. And that is that if you have a minority that is highly mobilized, energized, focused, knows what it wants, and is prepared to fight for it, it can move mountains. even though the Tea Party is a lot less popular than it was a year and a half ago, you still have 25% of the population saying that they sympathize with it, and that 25% has been enough to leverage a very substantial change in the center of gravity of the American political discussion. And so I think the caller is exactly right. If you want to have comparable influence in the other direction, got to organize, and you have to organize not just in Washington, not just with usual interest groups, but at the grassroots level as well.
Well, here are some comments from listeners along these lines. Christopher writes, don't blame Obama, blame the American people for being blinded by ideology. It is the Republican lawmakers elected by the people who are waging an ideological battle about the size and role of government and who have held the president at gunpoint. Obama simply does not have the political capital to resist, and his capitulation is only giving us what we deserve. Perhaps the disastrous fallout from this historic low point will wake us up to the reality of the instrumental role government plays in protecting and promoting our quality of life. And on our website, Gerald writes, it's not caving to admit that an opponent is more powerful and can get her way, given that the Tea Party didn't get everything they wanted. I would just count it as a loss. But anyone who fights or who practices for such knows that sometimes you lose because the opponent is stronger or more clever, which first itself is highly dependent on the territory in which you're fighting. The Republican and the majority in the House and their teabag faction were able to work their will because they had the nation hostage. We can complain about Obama's giving in as much as we like, but that's not unless we elect a Congress that will make it possible for him not to. And let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Roanert Park. Patrick, you're on.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, I'm going to bring a little different perspective into this. The debt ceiling is just a sideshow to distract the American people from the real issue, which hasn't even made the news, and that's that the GAO has completed its audit of the Fed and found that they've given away $16 trillion to a group of banks, which includes a lot of foreign banks. And the $16 trillion is not even included within the debt ceiling.
That is a major story, and I'm really glad you brought it up. Jared Bernstein, can I get you to comment on how that maybe figures into this whole picture?
Sure, but you're going to have to listen for a second first, if you don't mind, to a reflection on some of what was said a minute ago, because I think it's really important, gets to the heart of this, even more so than the $16 trillion issue. The last three callers and Bill's comment, I think, are very important, and they take some of the pressure off the president, or at least some of the blame. Could he have negotiated more strongly? Absolutely. But it's not his fault that he's in this spot. And while you can look at the left, as one of the callers did, and you know, argue that there's not enough left there, I would say that what's really missing is much more broad. It's not just a left, it's the center as well. It's a view that government does important things that are useful in people's life, does them well, does them more efficiently. There are some things that markets simply can't do well, that government has to step in and fill that gap. And if you don't believe that, then any measure of cuts, whether it's a trillion, 2 trillion, 4 trillion, probably sounds pretty good to you because you don't recognize what you're losing. And I think that's what's been missing. Without that behind him, it's very tough for the president to make this case. Look, in terms of the bar, I think that the argument that the caller makes is somewhat overblown. It's absolutely the case that the Federal Reserve has been pumping a ton of liquidity into this economy. But in fact, they've had to do so in order to keep the credit system flowing and to deal with what we now recognize as by far the deepest recession since the Great Depression, even worse than we thought with some new revised numbers. And I think the actions of the Federal Reserve and the Recovery Act that the administration implemented back in 2009 have helped a lot to stabilize the ship. The problem is we're just bumping along the bottom now. Sorry if I'm mixing metaphors here. And so I actually think those measures have been helpful. I think if you look at the indicators such as what we have to pay on Treasury bills to borrow, they're very low. They don't indicate any kind of an inflationary pressure or some kind of imbalance in the system in that regard.
Yeah, so, but $16 trillion. I mean, you know we used to talk about Everett Dirksen's. We used to make jokes about Everett Dirksen saying a billion here, a billion there. You know, this $16 trillion.
Yeah, well, this is an economy that this is an economy that if you actually look at the value of our goods and services, it's $15 trillion. If you look at the value of our capital stock, it's closer to $40 trillion. So, you know, we got some big numbers out there. Look, if there were alarm bells around that kind of borrowing, you would definitely see it in financial markets. You'd see bond yields going through the roof. Instead, you see the opposite. You actually see the dollar remains the strong currency of choice. You see the borrowing here. Our borrowing costs remain very low for the federal government. I worry about a ton of things every day. That isn't one of them.
Well, let me thank the caller and move on to more of your calls. We'll go to Mike next in Sacramento. Mike, join us.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. Say, one of my thoughts is a foreseeability issue. I think the president's been, first of all, I generally agree the president had almost a gun to his head, but my question is, or thought is, in December, before the change in the new members came in January, it seemed to be foreseeable, first of all, that the debt limit needed to be raised, and two, that these folks who got elected in November were, from my perspective, are crazy.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, too, because I think William Galson, I know you did an article that's about to appear in the New Republic, and you said that this could have been avoided if they did the debt increase by themselves in December.
Well, and I said that on this show not 15 minutes
right.
ago. That's true. And Congresswoman Lofgren made that point, and she's right, too. So, yeah.
Now, you also said in that article, I want to bring this in, too, that yeah. He should have put his fiscal commission report in the State of the Union.
Well, I mean, I've been making that argument now for 8 months, and and I reviewed the White House arguments offered against doing so back in January and against working it into the February budget. I found them less than persuasive, and I think if the administration had it to do all over again, they might have played that hand quite differently as well. But I think what we were focusing on is. Is what the administration ended up with, and whether it should be a source of anger as opposed to concern and a measure of frustration. And I think concern and frustration are warranted, depending on your perspective, but anger, I think, is going too far, and I think it's a mistake to direct it at the president.
Well, here's another listener who agrees with that. Richard writes, I keep hearing speakers saying the president didn't provide enough leadership or did not have necessary negotiation skills, but what specifically should he have done in trying to negotiate with bullheaded people willing to sacrifice the good of the country for their own win? What specifically should he have done in the leadership area? I think he did about all he could do in the face of the obstacles. But here's a listener, Ralph, who, well, may disagree with that. Ralph, go ahead. You're on.
Good morning. I think that what he should have done in that case is let the Republicans own it. Let them crash the economy for a week, and then when people don't get their Social Security checks for a week and their Medicare payments, you would see a real change in people's feelings on this matter and make the Republicans own it. Obama seems politically inept or surrounded by politically inept people, because outside of the false reality of the Beltway in the real world here, why am I supposed to, take heart in what Obama has done? Why am I supposed to vote for him?
Well, you heard Jackie Speier earlier say that her vote in favor of the bill was really to save the country from default. And Jared Bernstein, what about the idea that we're hearing here that maybe the Republicans should have owned it and default should have happened and then they would have been blamed and suffered the political fallout?
Look, it's not an argument that you don't hear. I mean, there's a significant group of folks who make the case that the caller just made, and it's not a crazy point. It's a point that's very, very risky, and this is a president who's clearly risk averse. If you signal to global markets that you are willing to default, that doesn't just shut things down for a week or so. That raises your cost of borrowing for years into the future. It also means if you stop making those payments that would occur if you had to start prioritizing who you paid and who you didn't, that you would be extracting as much as $100 billion out of the economy every month. You'd be essentially insuring a double-dip recession. So I get the point the caller makes, and I don't think and I see strategically where he's got a point in the sense that when you're dealing with people, as the president was, who view a particular outcome as much less cataclysmic than you do, you're very much at a negotiating disadvantage. So if you're not willing to go there with them, then the outcome is predicted from the beginning, and that was the case here. But I don't fault the president for not being willing to go there, or Congressman Speer for voting aye on this bill. I think I probably would have done the same thing because I'm in that same kind of risk-averse place that the caller isn't and that a lot of us other folks are.
And again, Jared Bernstein is the former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Biden. And here's somebody on the web who writes rather critically about Vice President Biden's language and use of the word terrorist. He says, is no one going to condemn intemperate language like referring to political opponents as terrorists? Remember all the talk about the need for civil discourse after the Arizona shooting? Another comment on the web, as much as I've been unhappy with Obama's performance in all this, I'm grateful we have not risked default, and I'm glad entitlements have been protected. That being said, health care is bloated and in dire need of reform. Could Democrats have used reforming Medicare and Medicaid as leverage? The new health care system does not address this. For example, doctors and hospitals could be paid for preventative medicine. This seems to be an obvious way to reduce our budget and persuade the public to voice their opinions Meyer favorably to the Democratic side. We should mention, by the way, apropos of what we just heard from Jared Bernstein, despite all these cuts, the country is still spending hundreds of billions of dollars a month. And the global markets, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, William Galston, have been affected by this? We heard the head of the IMF saying that the United States is now looked at from a whole different perspective in terms of the way it deals with its own fiscal house.
Yes, indeed, she did say that, and she went on to say that the automatic presumption in favor of the United States as the global economic leader has been weakened by this episode, and she said that regardless of the actual outcome of the negotiations, and I think that's very sobering. We have taken our economic leadership for granted ever since the Second World War, and we don't really understand the advantages, tangible and intangible, we've gotten out of that perception of steady and reasonably far-sighted leadership that pays attention to the interests of other countries as well as our own. And if that perception of the United States weakens or goes away, then we're in a whole new ball game, and we're in a ball game in which the status of the dollar as a reserve currency increasingly is called into question, in which American leadership of international financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank is attacked and reduced, and lots of other consequences that will flow through to the bottom line for households over time. So this is a game for very large stakes, and we'd better be careful from here on out that we don't give the world any more reason to doubt our sanity.
And again, William Galston is former Deputy Assistant for Domestic Policy in the Clinton administration, now Senior Fellow in Governance Studies with the Brookings Institution. And our next caller joining us from Knoxville, Tennessee, is Chuck. Chuck, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one being, how deep are the cuts requested for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? And is that being put off to the commission until November? And is their decision binding? And how are those members being chosen? My second question is, doesn't that put the liberals in an even worse position in that now they will hold unemployment extension benefits, extended benefits for unemployment hostage, as opposed to the debt ceiling, which is a much more palatable political choice as opposed to the debt ceiling?
Let me go to you, Jared Bernstein.
I didn't hear everything he asked, but I did hear enough to respond to some of the good questions. First of all, the members of the committee will be appointed, six Democrats, six Republicans, three from each party in each chamber. And their recommendations, which have to be into the Congress by Thanksgiving of this year, will get an up or down vote by the end of this year. If it's an upvote and they've recommended at least $1.5 trillion in spending cuts, or, by the way, revenue increases, that's as I think Bill mentioned earlier, that's an area where you could see some revenue come into the deal. By the way, very unlikely, because Boehner and McConnell, Speaker Boehner, Senator McConnell, have been very clear that the members they appoint will not be allowed to put revenues on the table. At any rate, if they fail to agree, if they deadlock, which I think is a pretty good possibility, then $1.2 trillion spending cuts go into play automatically. 50% defense, 50% what we call non-exempt discretionary, which means Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, they can't be cut at that point. But to answer one of the questions callers, the entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, those could undergo cuts by the committee, this committee of 12, when they're negotiating this $1.5 trillion of budget cuts, of spending cuts, over the course of this year. But we don't know what they'll come up with yet, so we don't have an answer.
Let me go back to you, William Galston. Who are the winners and losers in this ultimately, as you see it?
Well,
I mean, the Republicans and the Tea Parties, are they the big winners in this, and the Democrats the losers? I'll put it to you that bluntly.
From a political standpoint, I'm not sure there are any winners. I just looked at a survey this morning, and in the state of Pennsylvania, which is a pretty good microcosm of the country as a whole, 28% of the people approve of the way the Democrats have conducted themselves in this affair. And guess what? 28% approve of the way the Republicans have conducted themselves in this affair. If there were any way of voting for none of the above, two-thirds of the American people would do so. President Obama has obviously taken a hit politically. If you look at his poll ratings, this has affected him negatively, the way the killing of Osama bin Laden affected him positively, and perhaps the hit will be temporary, but there is some fear that it will be more than temporary.
Well, we're coming. That's going to have to be the final remark here, because we've come to the end of the program, and I want to remind listeners that we had framed this as the struggle of the Democrats and those on the left, because there are a number of people who said they wanted to hear some Republican voices in this, and that's why you didn't. We spoke with Jackie Speer and Zoe Lofgren, two local Democratic congressional representatives. I want to thank Jared Bernstein, and thank William Galston, and thank Michael Doyle, who were with us this hour. Thank you, our listeners, and thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Another hour ahead of Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.